This is the Medic Cast, February 11th, 2008.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medic Cast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medic Cast, episode 104. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I want to welcome you to the show and welcome you to the beginning of year three here at the Medic Cast. If you were listening to last week's episode, you heard me talking about the second anniversary of the show and all of the things I was able to do over the past couple of years and some of the ideas I have for the coming year here at the Medic Cast. I want to thank all of you for checking in over the past couple of years and keeping in touch. And I also want to congratulate the winners of the giveaways here at the Medic Cast. I've gotten in touch with all of the winners except for one, and I'll be getting in touch with that person by email again. If you did not get an email from me specifically saying you were one of the second anniversary winners, then you did not win one of the prizes because I only released first names, so you might have thought it was you. But you would have had to have been, first of all, a subscriber to the Medic Cast newsletter and also have received an email from me on the newsletter email address that you've provided. So if you didn't get any of that, I apologize for you not winning, at least this time. But if you're on the newsletter, stay tuned because that is the way I choose people that are listeners of the show to receive prizes and giveaways that I have throughout the course of the year. If you're not a member of the newsletter service yet, you can go to mediccast.com. Check out the link in the upper right-hand corner of the site. You'll see a big badge that says Medicast Podcast Newsletter. You get all the links from the show every week delivered directly to you, and occasionally one more email or so a month when I have something important to report on. So four or five emails a month. I don't spam your inbox with a lot of extra junk, and you can get all of that information sent to you directly from me here at the Medic Cast. So check it out over at mediccast.com and check out the newsletter site. All right, enough of that. Let's get into this week's listener emails. I'll start off with an email that I received from listener Jerry. He's one of the many listeners that we have down in Australia for the Medic Cast. And Jerry wanted to drop an email for me about tactical medics and wanted to know if I wanted to talk about tactical EMS. And it's not a topic that I'm very familiar with, but maybe it's something I need to learn more about. So, Jerry, I want to thank you very much for your email on that topic, and maybe I'll include you with some of your experiences, and we can follow up on exactly how you got into tactical EMS and what you learned about it. And also, I'll follow up with you on that, and maybe some other folks that maybe are instructors or have some experience in tactical EMS. We can make that a topic of a future show. Or maybe, if it's enough interest, maybe we should talk about it on an episode of the Medic Cast Live. Let's see about that, too. So, Jerry, thanks for your comment. Jerry also asked about getting a T-shirt in Australia. If you are overseas, I can ship T-shirts anywhere. The free shipping here in the U.S. is about to end, but for overseas shipping, there is a link on the page where you go to sign up at PayPal. It'll actually select overseas shipping, and there's a flat rate pricing there. I think it's $11 U.S. for overseas priority first-class shipping. So if you'd like to take advantage of that and pick up a Medic Cast T-shirt or a Medic Cast T-shirt and water bottle bundle, go ahead and check out the link in the store at store.medicast.com. I got another email from Australia here from listener Flo. Flo, I'm going to assume you are a female, so I'll go ahead and continue with that premise. If I'm wrong, send me another email and I'll give myself a smack to the head. Flo is completing her training as a paramedic or working on getting that completed, and she has recently been working on her driving training as an emergency driver. And she wanted to comment based on some of the reporting I've been doing recently on motor vehicle accidents and ambulances and some of the things she's learned. Just as a reminder, First of all, making sure that you plan ahead. Make sure you have plenty of stopping distance and that you plan your route of travel at all times so that if you have multiple lanes to choose from, you can plan where to evade to if you have to avoid something directly in front of you. Good pointer there. Also, talking about remembering to drive smoothly with patients and other providers in the back so that they can provide care without too much jostling and bumping around, and also navigating and orienting yourself to your region so that you can make the best choices about route of travel. All of those are great ideas, Flo. Thank you very much. And maybe we'll have to do another revisit on EVOC or emergency vehicle operator standards. So we'll take care of that in another future episode. And I want to thank you very much and good luck with your paramedic training down in Australia, Flo. That's it for listener emails this week. You keep the emails coming in by reaching me here at podmedic@mac.com. And you can also leave comments directly on the website. If you're interested in even getting in touch with me in different ways, check out forums.medicast.com. That'll take you directly to the MedicCast forums. There's been a lot of great discussions started and continuing over there at the MedicCast forums. It's an opportunity for you to not just talk with me, but talk with other listeners for the MedicCast about topics that are of interest specifically to you. And we try to provide a lot of great information over there. Myself, Rick Rosati, Chris Black, and a bunch of others all check in over there regularly, so you want to make sure that you stay in touch by visiting forums.medicast.com. It's time for the link of the week, and this week, because it's coming up on the second Tuesday of the month, is a link to this month's episode of the MedicCast Live. This is your opportunity to call in live or chat on the chat room live with me and the other experts here at the MedicCast and talk about whatever topic it is we happen to be covering this month. And that's this Tuesday night, the 12th of February at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and it'll be your opportunity to really keep in touch with what's going on here at the MedicCast. This month, because it's February and it's coming up on Valentine's Day, I'm going to be talking about living with an EMS provider. What is it that we do that works with our significant others, boyfriends, girlfriends, whatever it might be? What is it that we do that drives them nuts? And what can we do to improve communication and try to keep things stable at the home scene? In order to do that, I have got two very special guests planned, and hopefully they're both still available, one of whom is my own wife, Amy, who will be here to talk about her experiences living with an EMS provider, and also Rick Rosati, I think his wife, will also be able to join us and talk about some of her experiences. This will be an opportunity to really look at some of the myths about EMS spouses and EMS significant others and EMS home life, and also look at some of the things we can do to improve those aspects of our lives. All of that coming up this Tuesday night on the MedicCast Live. And if you've been hoping to win a t-shirt, one lucky listener that listens live that night will get a code to email me in the subject line of an email, and they will get the information on how to win their own t-shirt. One of the people that emails me that code will get a free t-shirt from the MedicCast store just for tuning in. So it's a great opportunity for you to check out the show live, comment live, and you can do all of that at MedicCastLive.com using TalkShoe.com as the service for running that show. And you'll find out more about that if you follow the link in the show notes or go directly to MedicCastLive.com. Time now to jump on into this week's news. And the first news item I will look at has to do with the value of taking daytime naps. And it's something that we all need to kind of keep in the back of our minds. We work very long hours and we try to keep up with continuing education. Some of us are working long hours and going to school. What can we do to improve our ability to function both with good memory as a good student and good memory as a good provider on the street? Well, I found a study listed over at WebMD talking about a recent study on undergraduate students that looked at how they could use napping to improve their memory. These students took three different tests to look at their short-term memory. They took the tests before and after napping. One of the tests paired unrelated words like alligator and cigar. Another test they had to use a computer and navigate a maze and then remember how to navigate in that maze. Lastly, some of them were required to copy a drawing after looking at it, copy it from memory onto a piece of paper. Now, these tests were conducted before, and then a control group was sent to watch TV and not take a nap, while another group was sent to take a short 45-minute nap. Now, one of the tests, the paired of unrelated words, actually showed a significant improvement following the nap. The other two tests did not seem to show that much difference. However, what researchers did find was that people who scored highest on the earlier test before their nap seemed to see the best improvement after they took their nap. And so what this seems to show is that if you study and work on retaining that memory, if you actually are able to work and study and get information into your brain, that going and taking a nap or going to sleep will actually reinforce those memories. There seems to be some boost based on the level of learning that you are able to complete. So if you did a good job of studying and worked hard on that, rather than just idly looking at something and committed that memory worked better following taking a nap. So this is just a little support for us to remember that getting good sleep, no matter how we do it, even if it's in short bites here and there, may go a long way to significantly improving our ability to perform both as students and as providers in the field. I always try to point out these little studies when they come up, and I will do so again in the future as I find others. The next item in the news I found over at medicinenet.com and looks at a study that examines the differences between people who really have severe asthma attacks on a regular basis versus those that seem to have a milder form of the disease. And one of the things that they found was that there may be actually a significant difference in the disease that these people have. It may actually be a different disease. What they found was that the people who have severe asthma attacks on a regular basis tend to trap air more consistently and show little change in their airway openings even following treatment. Now, this is something that anybody who's had to deal with a severe asthmatic in their units have seen, where it just seems like no matter what you do, you can't do anything more than just a little bit of assistance. You give them oxygen, you try to give them albuterol, Atrovent, maybe you have the ability to give steroids in your units or provide other resources, and yet no matter what you do, you seem to be just running into a brick wall. This is what this study found, was that these people always showed signs of significant air trapping in their lungs and that they were unable to fully exhale and that they continued to have airway obstruction even after advanced treatments were administered. This is different from people with milder asthma who seem to have a case that responds very well to the drugs and treatments that are provided in the field. And so what can we do about this? Well, hopefully these findings can go towards developing newer treatments, more focused treatments for severe cases of asthma. And while those treatments may not reach us in the field, it's important for us to remember to pay attention to our patients that have a history of asthma or are experiencing an ongoing asthma attack, because these are the patients that we need to be very proactive in treating. We need to ask important questions about their asthma, questions like, what happened the last time you had a severe asthma attack? When was the last time you were intubated? You may find out that they're intubated frequently because of their asthma attacks, and that leads you to expedite transport and prepare for severe airway management issues and be prepared to intubate these patients and provide assistance if needed. So all of that's good information, and you can check out the link to this article in the show notes for yourself. The next item I will look at has to do with mercury in vaccines and the supposed link between mercury and vaccines and vaccinations in general and autism. And if any of you have been listening to my show for some length of time, you know that I really don't have much patience with people that believe everything they read or hear on the internet. And I guess that's strange since you listen to me on the internet, but I always try to provide links back to authoritative sources of peer-reviewed scientific research. And I think that's something that just doesn't happen in the rest of the community that deals with this autism and vaccine link, which I think most of what they do focuses on the fear that parents have rather than dealing with the logic and reality of the situation. This latest story has to do with a study that has been conducted looking specifically at the type of mercury in the preservative in some, and I say some, vaccines, because the United States Food and Drug Administration has severely limited the access to using this particular drug preservative in vaccines. It's all but gone in most vaccines, and it's been severely reduced in amount in the vaccines that it still remains active in. So why is this a problem? Well, there's been a problem where parents have said that the mercury in their children's vaccines made their child autistic. And this has been a relational study that is based on anecdotal evidence and the fact that parents found that their children, who are usually diagnosed with autism around 2 years of age, seems to coincide within a few months of a recent vaccination. Well, guess what? That's because all kids get vaccinations around the age of two, and they get some more at three. And so if your kid is diagnosed recently in conjunction with a recent vaccine, well, that's no different than saying they ate a peanut butter sandwich for lunch, and it must have caused their autism. But parents can't explain that to some parents. And so this myth has gotten out there and been propagated again and again and again, despite the fact that scientific research has shown no causal relationship between thimerosal and autism. So what does this really mean? Well, the reduction of thimerosal in the vaccine as a preservative doesn't have as great of an effect in the United States, but it does have a significant effect worldwide, where they cannot easily refrigerate the vaccines to preserve them if they have a reduced shelf life because of the presence or lack of presence of this particular preservative. And so this study looked at how quickly people get rid of the mercury that is found in this particular type of chemical. It's a different kind of mercury than is commonly found in foodstuffs like fish and shellfish and seafood items that is always a concern. This particular form of mercury is actually cleared 10 times faster from the system. And in fact, in this study, infants who were vaccinated with twice the amount of thimerosal in their vaccine compared to infants who were not vaccinated had the same levels of mercury 2 months after the vaccination. That's significant. That means that these infants virtually had no effect, that this mercury was cleared by their gut, it never got into their systems, and it never was eliminated via their kidneys like the other forms of mercury that are commonly found. This is important because it means that thimerosal is still safe to transport and use as a long shelf life preservative for vaccines and available for third world countries, and is another key study that points out that there is no significant relationship between autism and the administration of vaccines, and that parents who don't vaccinate their children are only putting their children at risk for life-threatening childhood illnesses and not saving them from the threat of autism. I'll wrap up the news today with a story that comes from the American College of Physicians, and they are looking at the nation's presidential candidates as well as the congressional candidates that are running for the election this year, and they're saying that there is a definite need to get insurance coverage for every American citizen, young, old, in between, saying that the U.S. healthcare system is failing and that Congress and presidential candidates need to step in now and get healthcare reform in place and provide universal coverage for members and citizens of this country. I think this is something that many of us would agree is needed, at least for certain populations. I don't know where you fall on this, but I think a lot of our ER overcrowding, a lot of our overuse of the ambulances can directly be traced back to the fact that patients don't have ready access or economic access to healthcare. And so they end up utilizing the emergency response system and the emergency departments in their local hospitals as primary care medical centers, often later than they might have had they had easier access in other routes. And so these patients show up more significantly affected by their health problem and also require more in-depth treatment, as well as the increased costs of activating EMS or going to the emergency department. All of these things are significant in the United States and are a problem and need to be handled now in order to get people the coverage that they so desperately need. And this is something that you've heard me talk about it before. I feel very strongly about this issue. I think this affects all of us, both in the field and as members of a family and a community. So let me just throw this out there for you and just say that I think it's important, no matter which way you feel on this or any other political issue, that it's important that you participate in the process here in the United States. If you do not have currently the ability to vote in your area because you aren't registered, you need to go out and get registered. If you're worried that you're going to be working a 24-hour shift that day, then you can go ahead and get an absentee ballot. The one thing that drives me nuts is when people complain about a problem that can be at least partially fixed by being involved in the electoral process, and then they don't vote. I don't have anything to say to them anymore once I find out that they don't vote. I don't have to argue with them anymore because their opinion doesn't matter. If you want your opinion to matter, you have to vote. So if you don't agree with me on this issue, that's fine, but you can go ahead and vote and get your voice heard, and then we can have an intelligent discussion on the topic. That's going to wrap up the news, and it's time now to look at this week's tip and trick of the week. And this week, I'm going to do a double tip of the week instead of a tip and a med, and really try to dig into one topic that's something I've covered. I covered this also recently over at the Nursing Show at nursingshow.com. That's one of my other podcasts. So if you know any nurses out there that would like to listen to a show dealing with nursing issues and nursing diagnosis, nursing assessment and other problems facing nurses, they can check out nursingshow.com. Particularly, I'm going to be looking at some anatomy and physiology as well as some assessment dealing with neurology checks and specifically the cranial nerves. Now, if you're an EMTB, you may not have gotten this far into the anatomy of the brain and the nervous system, but the cranial nerves are what we look at when we do things like check for pupillary response, when we ask and talk to people about making a grimace or a smile during a check for a stroke. Cincinnati Stroke Scale looks at cranial nerve response for things like that. And so what do we do when we look at cranial nerves, and what do the cranial nerves pertain to? So that's what this particular topic is going to be covering. The 12 cranial nerves are the nerves that originate in the brain that generally affect the shoulders, neck, and up. And these are the primary sensory nerves of sight, of smell, taste, hearing, as well as facial expression, speech, and swallowing, things like that. These nerves really cover important aspects of what's going on in our brains. And by the ability to understand what works where and how the cranial nerves activate parts of our sensory or motor systems, we can actually identify specific areas of the brain that might be affected and also look at changes in the effects on those cranial nerves to see whether the problem is worsening or getting better. So there are different ways to remember the cranial nerves. There are some G-rated mnemonic devices and some not so G-rated mnemonic devices. I'm going to keep this work safe and we'll try the mnemonic device I found over at the wiki page on cranial nerves. On old Olympus's towering tops, a Finn and German viewed some hops. Okay, so that's one mnemonic you can use and represents a way to remember OOTTAFAGVSH, specifically pertaining to the olfactory nerve, the optic nerve, oculomotor nerve, trochlear nerve, trigeminal nerve, abducens nerve, facial nerve, vestibulocochlear nerve, or the auditory nerve or acoustic nerve, glossopharyngeal nerve, vagus nerve, accessory nerve, or also known as the spinal accessory nerve, and hypoglossal nerve. So what do these nerves do? Well, some of these are involved solely in sensory aspects, while others are motor nerves, and some of them have both sensory and motor function. And in order to do that, you have to do the second memory mnemonic, which you put under the other one, and it tells you which ones are sensory, which are motor, and which are both, by saying, "Some say money matters, but my brother says big brains matter more." And by saying SSMMBMBSBBMM, you can remember which ones are sensory, which ones are motor, and which ones have aspects of both. So let's look at the cranial nerves and see what we are talking about here. The first two are sensory nerves. The olfactory nerve, dealing with the sense of smell, is cranial nerve number one. Cranial nerve 2 is the optic nerve, and this merely transmits visual information from the eye to the brain. Isn't responsible for pupil response or anything else, but if someone can't see clearly or has sudden blurred vision, it may be related to a problem with this optic nerve. There are now oculomotor, trochlear as 3 and 4, and then I'm going to skip over 5 and go right to 6, the abducens nerve. 3, 4, and 6 are related to the movement of the eye and the eyelid. And the reason I say that is these are the three you can test pretty easily to see if the eye is moving normally. You can test these by holding your finger or using your pen light and moving it up, down, left, right, and into the corners of the eye. Okay, so you're like drawing the compass points, okay? You can then focus in by pushing the pen light towards the nose or pulling it away to see if they can track that movement. If they are unable to track or one eye isn't tracking as well as the other, that may be a sign that there's something that's causing a problem with that particular pair or that particular nerve on that side. And so these nerves are all pairs of nerves because they each affect a different side of the body. You can sometimes figure out exactly where the problem lies. So that's 3, 4, and 6 on the cranial nerves. We'll go back to cranial nerve 5, the trigeminal nerve. And this is a nerve that both helps with chewing. It moves the muscles that help to chew, some of them anyway, and also receives general sensation from the face. And you can test this by having someone close their eyes and just brushing their face with a piece of gauze or with your fingertip and see if they feel that. We'll now skip ahead to cranial nerve 7. Remember, 3, 4, and 6 move the eye. 5 provides sensation for the face and assists with chewing. So now 7 is called the facial nerve, and the facial nerve is responsible for facial expression. Also, it is involved in production of tears and saliva, as well as providing some aspects of taste for a portion of the tongue. Moving down to 8, you have the acoustic nerve, or the vestibulocochlear nerve. This is responsible for balance and sound production. It is a sensory nerve, so it's really just going to be focused on the sensory functions around the ear, and that includes both your vestibular sense, or your sense of balance, and the sensation of sound waves and transmission of those sound waves to the brain. Cranial nerve number 9 is the glossopharyngeal nerve. And again, you can try to remember glosso refers to the tongue, okay? Pharyngeal, pharynx, refers to the back of the throat. This is involved in receiving taste from a portion of the tongue. It also gives some assistance to producing saliva in some of the salivary glands and produces movement for the tongue, and also provides some response in the back of the throat for the gag reflex. So you can find some reaction to patients with this particular pair of nerves, the glossopharyngeal nerve. Remember, tongue movement, taste, and sensation in the back of the throat are the keys here. The 10th cranial nerve should be near and dear to all of us in EMS. It's the vagal nerve, the vagus nerve, And the vagal response is something we talk about when we deal with things like cardiac arrest and CPR, or when we bag patients, because we don't want to do anything to stimulate a vagal response, which will decrease heart rate. That's because the vagus nerve actually has functions in the head and neck, but also extends down into the thoracic cavity and even into the abdominal cavity. It involves the parasympathetic responses, which slows heart rate, increases GI production, and so we do things to stimulate this nerve can stimulate a bradycardia. That's why we talk about pulling the face up into the bag valve mask rather than pressing the bag mask down on the face, especially in children. That pressure can stimulate vagal response and cause a bradycardia. The vagus nerve is also responsible for the movement functions of speech and some taste function in the mouth, as well as movement of swallowing in the laryngeal and pharyngeal muscles. So this would be something that you would want to follow up on. A patient who's having trouble swallowing, you can just ask them, can you swallow right now, or is it difficult, or you seem uncoordinated? This may be something that is happening. Finally, you have the spinal accessory nerve and the hypoglossal nerves, 11 and 12. The spinal accessory nerve, also known as the accessory nerve, it has a couple of different names, but it can easily remember the spinal accessory nerve. Think about your spine going down your neck. It controls the muscles of the neck and overlaps sometimes with some functions of the vagus nerve, including swallowing, things like that. You can test this nerve by just asking the patient to shrug. Okay, or turn their head or against the pressure of your hand. If they're weak to one side or the shrug doesn't come up evenly, that is an indication that they're having a problem with one side of this nerve pair. The hypoglossal nerve, you can think about the fact that, again, it deals with the tongue, but also hypo, below. That means below the tongue. So it deals with the muscles of the tongue as well as assisting with swallowing with the epiglottis and other aspects in the lower pharynx of the head. So you're dealing with these 12 nerves and how to test them. What would you be looking for? And how would you understand if there was a problem? So I think that's time now to move on into the next part of today's tip and trick, the doubling up that I talked about earlier. We're going to look at intracranial pressure and some of the things we might be looking for and track with dealing with patients who have suspected intracranial pressure. So what do we talk about when we think about intracranial pressure? What does that mean? Intracranial pressure. It means exactly what it says, intra, inside the head, cranial pressure. The reason this is such an issue is, unlike just about any other part of the body, the brain case, the cranium, cannot withstand any major changes in pressure inside without causing damage to the tissues contained therein. And of course, those tissues are the tissues of the brain. Things that can cause increased pressure in the brain and therefore increase pressure in the cranium or in the brain vault will all cause damage by shifting the brain around, by causing eventually herniation where it starts to push the brain down through the foramen at the base of the skull, down through that opening, and you start seeing very severe issues and almost irreversible problems. But this is all starting with a recognition of the early signs of intracranial pressure. And if you can recognize those signs and deal with them appropriately in the field, there may not be a whole lot you can do, but you can do some things to not make the problem worse and get the patient to the proper center for treatment. And those are the key interventions that I'm going to focus on here. But first of all, let's look at assessment. Intracranial pressure can be increased by a hemorrhagic stroke. It can be increased by a thrombolytic stroke that has caused tissue ischemia and therefore swelling localized to a portion of the brain. You also have infectious problems like encephalitis or meningitis that may cause swelling, as well as traumatic brain injury. Patients who have that coup contra coup injury from the movement forwards and backwards of the head. You see this in shaken baby syndrome. You see it in motor vehicle accidents where the patient first went forward and then slammed back and then came back again. That sloshing of the brain in there causes bruising to the brain. Another problem can be found when there's bleeds in or around the brain. I talked about stroke directly in the brain tissue itself, but either from an injury or spontaneously, people can develop a bleed out in the meninges. Okay, these are the three layers of the covering of the brain, the dura mater, the arachnoid, and the pia mater. All are involved in covering the brain, and anything that causes a bleed in this potential space between these membranes can cause a increased force as that space fills up with blood and presses on the brain tissue. Remember, it can't expand outward through the skull. It's enclosed. So this becomes a bigger problem. And as that pressure increases, you will start to see changes in reflexes, changes in level of consciousness, and changes in the response to tests on the cranial nerves. And that's why I covered them first. Because if you look at the cranial nerves, you can sometimes track progression of some of these issues. Now, this is something you need to practice regularly and look at. We are supposed to be checking pupillary response on a regular basis, but there are other things that can be done. First of all, we need to remember to utilize the Glasgow Coma Scale. Okay, the progression of a tracked GCS will show you how those changes progress as that level of consciousness decreases. It doesn't mean anything when I say, oh, the patient's lethargic. What does lethargic mean to you? It probably means a little bit something different to every person. What's the difference between someone who is lethargic and someone who is stuporous? Or someone who is altered mental status? What does that mean? That's the value of the Glasgow Coma Scale. The Glasgow Coma Scale looks directly at a patient's level of consciousness and tracks it on a scale from 3 to 15. As that scale decreases or increases, you can see changes in the level of consciousness. And it's that trending process that can help you try to see if there has been indeed a change that is for the better or for the worse. Some of the things that you're going to look for in these patients, besides altered mental status, behavioral changes, headache may be an indication that there's a problem, or at least an early indication that can lead you to look for these other things. Again, progressive decreased level of consciousness, other neurological problems relating back to those cranial nerves, changes in pupillary response are a great one. Remember, the eyes are the windows to the brain. You can look at the eyes. If you start seeing a change over time, this is why it's important to reassess patients. You start seeing a change in pupillary response. One side is becoming more sluggish. One side is becoming more dilated than the other side. The only way to know about this change is to make sure you assess it early and then assess it often on down the road. Patients may also begin to experience seizures, and they may begin vomiting because of a stimulation and a shock response related to the increased intracranial pressure. You're also likely to see a common response known as the Cushing's triad, and this is distinguishable from shock in a key way. Remember, in shock, a late sign of shock would be decreased blood pressure, decreased heart rate, and decreased respirations, the very late signs of shock. The differences between this in a testing situation and increased intracranial pressure will be that in the case of an increased intracranial pressure, you will actually have an increased blood pressure. You'll have bradycardia, you'll have bradypnea or slowed respirations, but you will have an increased blood pressure. And this increased blood pressure is because the body is trying to push the blood past that increased pressure in the brain. And it, as the pressure in the brain becomes closer and closer to the systolic blood pressure, you start seeing more and more problems. You also see a widening of pulse pressure as an early indication of potential increased intracranial pressure. That pulse pressure is the difference between the systolic and the diastolic blood pressures. If that distance is getting wider and wider, you know, they used to be 120 over 80, and now they're 122 over 60, and a little bit later they're, you know, 118 over 50. Well, this is a widening pulse pressure, and you'd want to see a problem and look at other indications. Start testing those cranial nerves. Start checking level of consciousness regularly. All these things can be indicative of a problem with intracranial pressure. Cushing's response, that Cushing, or not response, but Cushing's triad says that you're going to have decreased heart rate, decreased breathing respirations, and an increased blood pressure. And if you think about why that is. You've got that increased vagal response, which is slowing down that heart rate and that respiratory response, and you have an increased blood pressure as the systemic vasculature tries to push the blood past that pressure gradient in the brain. You're also going to want to look at something like the respiratory rate as a problem. Now, we used to hyperventilate suspected head injury patients, but the problem became that we actually hyperventilated them too much. If you have the ability to follow capnography, you want to maybe slightly hyperventilate the patient. And by slightly, I mean instead of keeping them between 35 and 45, that normal range for your carbon dioxide level in your blood, the capnography is going to be kept somewhere around 30 to 35, just slightly lower than normal. We don't want to get them below 30 where we're just oxygenating the heck out of them. Too much carbon dioxide in the blood causes vasodilation, and that vasodilation in the brain is going to increase the amount of blood in the brain and increase the pressure. By reducing it slightly, we can keep the vessels from vasodilating, but if we give them too much oxygen, that actually causes vesiculations, causes little tremors in the vessels, and that itself causes increased pressure. So we have to really maintain that level. Don't hyperventilate unless your protocols call for it. And if you have the ability to use capnography, you can really keep that capnography target number just slightly lower than that normal number. Will probably have a good positive effect and not cause that increased oxygenation, vesiculation of the arterioles that can cause increased pressure in itself. So what about if you're a BLS or an ALS provider? Most of what you're going to do is going to be BLS skills here, folks. We're talking about basic assessment. We're talking about following up on trending that assessment. And we're talking about good, proper ventilation. And that is all BLS skills. In fact, I think capnography should be a BLS skill. So these are all things that anybody can do as a provider. You can also check on patient positioning. Slightly elevating the head about 30 degrees or less will, again, use gravity to help keep some of the additional pressure off the brain. You don't want to raise the legs. You don't want to greatly flex the hips because you don't want to put pressure on the abdominal space, which will push upward, putting additional pressure on the thoracic space and causing decreased return blood flow, which will increase pressure. So there are little things you can do. Less movement of the patient as possible will help out there as well. Less movement of the head and anything that might put pressure. That means if you're going to bag the patient, you really want to use good bag mask skills. Use an extra person to hold the mask firmly to the face without pressing down, lifting the face up into the mask in a proper technique, and then bagging the patient. In that way, you will be able to decrease the amount of pressure. Intubation of these patients may be indicated, but again, you want to reduce the amount of movement on the patient and the patient's head, and you want to try to avoid additional vagal response and pressure because that will also have an adverse effect. So that's a quick look at intracranial pressure and the cranial nerves. I urge you to check back and review that. It's a great way to keep up on what's going on. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the Medicast. I want to remind all of you to check back next week and check out the next episodes and back episodes as you need to stay current on what you need to learn here at the Medicast. I also want to thank all of you for spreading the word about the Medicast. Tell a friend this week about the Medicast. Let somebody else know about some of the great information you've found at the Medicast site. If you're a student, share the site with your friends and colleagues in class, as well as your instructor. Your instructors can contact me directly, and I would be happy to take their suggestions on topic areas to cover here, and I certainly don't mind helping out their classroom experience as well. You can contact me here directly by email at podmedic@mac.com, or you can reach me by voicemail at 941-306-3342. That voicemail number again is 941-30-MEDIC. If you want to, you can comment directly on the website as well. I put up a lot of articles throughout the week, all of which are intended to keep you in touch with current studies and news surrounding medicine in general and EMS specifically. A reminder for you to check out the Medicast forums at forums.medicast.com. The Medicast forums is a great way for you to have conversations, not just with me, but also with the other listeners in the Medicast. And I find that the community response is a great way to get information out to each other. It's a great way for all of you to share information, share things you've learned so that other people don't have to learn the hard way and can learn from our own mistakes. All right, enough of me talking. Time to wrap up the show. I'll end, as I always do, with some great PodSafe music. This week, another song by a good friend of the show, Matthew Ebel. Matthew came out with another new song called Downtown, and I really like it. It's got a little funk beat to it and really is something I enjoy. Check out the links to Matt's music in the show notes. Head on over to Matt's site and let him know you heard his song here on the Medicast. I know he'd appreciate hearing from you. And if you like what you hear, you can check out Matt's music directly via the link to the iTunes site if you'd like to purchase his songs. There's a way to do that as well in the show notes for this episode. I'll close out the show, as I always do, by saying, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. I'll see you again here next week. Until then, scene safety, BSI. Yeah.
get a cell, your daddy gonna raise hell. He gives you money, but honey, your daddy.